From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Business school isn't cheap. Up to $200,000, $250,000 for three little letters, MBA. But students are still pouring in, filling programs to the brim. Longtime Fortune columnist and humorist Stanley Bing says, save your money. Real-world experience and insights, he says, beat a seat in the ivory tower. He's out with a new book with some laughs and some serious, irreverent advice. This hour on Point, Stanley Bing on what you really need to master the world of business. You can join the conversation. MBAs, B-school grads, was going right or wrong for you? And what do you say to Stanley Bing's forget about it advice? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll look at the still-climbing super salary trend in executive pay. As for MBAs, yeah, they know that their rep isn't exactly ideal sometimes. Here's a little bit from a video from the Wharton Follies annual spring comedy show written, produced, performed by Wharton MBA students. A job applicant here epitomizes, they see it, a Wharton man.
My name is David Gallagher. I'm 26 years old. And I attend the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. I'm wearing a Valentino suit, Bulgari watch, and a leather Gucci belt.
Okay, a little self-awareness of the downside reputation, but they get poked from outside, too. In 2005, FedEx, no less, took to advertising how easy their new website was to use. Along the way, they took a big jab at MBAs.
Hi, Tom. I know it's your first day, but we could really use your help.
You got it.
Thanks. We're just in a bit of a jam. All this has to get out today.
Yeah, I don't do shipping.
Oh, no. It's very easy. We use FedEx.com. Anybody can do it.
No, you don't understand. I have an MBA.
Oh, you have an MBA. In that case, I'll have to show you how to do it.
Great, from FedEx. Joining me now from New York is Stanley Bing. For more than a decade, he's been a wise guy humorist and columnist for Fortune magazine, author of Executrix, Crazy Bosses, and Sun Tzu Was a Sissy. Behind the pen name, Stanley Bing goes by Gil Schwartz, and he's Senior Executive VP and Chief Communications Officer, in fact, for CBS Corporation. But today, he's Stanley Bing. His new book out this week is The Curriculum, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Master of Business Arts. Stanley Bing, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here. Thank you.
Okay, let's pop your bubble. You're just selling a book here. I mean, MBAs, surely they do some good stuff out there. You want to sell your funny curriculum, but you got kids with careers in mind, and don't they need an MBA to get going, Stanley?
No, for the most part, they don't need an MBA to get going. If they're in finance, I think there's a pretty good rationale for the kind of things they teach in business school. But many, many successful people that I know came nowhere near an MBA. Some actually didn't even go to college, but we'll pass that by for the time being. MBAs teach certain business schools. Classic business education teaches certain things. It's an intensely rational process, teaches things that are valuable to certain disciplines. But it's being oversold to people as a solution, much in the same way that law school was oversold to people for decades. If you didn't know what you were doing, you went to law school, and then you graduated from law school and then had to figure out what you were doing. I mean, in my discipline of communications, in a lot of things that people do, including sales, you don't need your MBA. I mean, if you want one, that's fine. But it's being sold as a panacea for all business problems. And I think my curriculum is a lot closer to what people need to know. I mean, for instance, I begin my course of study, which is really quite rigorous.
And
I begin with an entire chapter on not appearing stupid. And I think that's course one, which, by the way, you never graduate from. You continue to think about ways not to appear stupid because, in many ways, appearing stupid is actually worse than being stupid.
So we're in the front row for Stanley Bing's course on not appearing stupid. Give us a sense of the flavor of what you're advising here for would-be business whizzes who want to skip the B-school program.
Well, you know, I mean, very few disciplines other than finance, you really need to be completely sophisticated in finance, for instance, in economics and finance. By the way, I don't really think anybody is particularly schooled in economics, but that's a different issue.
Yeah.
You need to give the appearance that you know what's going on. And this extends, by the way, to the top levels of corporations. There's always somebody who really does understand. And the other people I advise to do three things. One is know certain bedrock terms, know what EBITDA, for instance, mm-hmm. or more recently, OIBDA.
At the bottom of your spreadsheet.
It's a bit of a bogus number because EBITDA was invented about 20 years ago to disguise the fact that profits weren't as good as they appeared to be. It eliminates a whole bunch of things that you actually have to pay for. But so I do describe EBITDA, mm-hmm. OIBDA. EPS is very important. The importance of knowing what your company's market cap, for instance, there are about five or six mm-hmm. things that if you don't know them, you will appear stupid.
Fundamental fluency, or you look like a dork.
You're possibly be stupid if you don't know those very, very few things. Beyond that, I suggest something called selective questioning, which means that when you're looking at a big spreadsheet or a complicated chart, you ask the finance person or the person who actually knows what's going on, you single out one cell of that spreadsheet and you look at it and you go, you know, this is interesting, Bob or Betty. What is this column? What does this number actually signify? Now, by doing that, you're saying, well, I understand, of course, the rest of this massive spreadsheet. This thing needs questioning. And by the way, it plays to the ego of the financial person who is only too happy to describe this arcana to you. And the third thing is a tool that I've used throughout my career, and I believe all serious business people use, and it's called sagacious nodding. And what that means is that if you don't really know what's going on, then don't attempt to appear that you do. Just nod. Now, don't nod too much because people will think you're nodding off or you're, you know, kissing up. But there is a quality of just nodding intelligently, and you have nothing to offer at that point. And no one can nail you for that. And if someone questions you about something, you can say, I'm listening. I don't know what I think yet. That's a respectable answer. But the sagacious nodding is another tactic.
When you get off into sagacious nodding and you give, of course, hairstyle advice as well, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, it almost sounds, you write for Fortune. I mean, mm-hmm. business can be silly, but it can also be serious. It sounds like how to succeed in business without really trying. The sort of idea that it's all a big farce and just nod sagaciously and what's the difference?
Not at all, really. It's what I'm saying is that business is, in a way, an irrational pursuit, mm-hmm. That it involves humanity. It involves manipulation and understanding of other people. It involves qualities like patience and mm-hmm. madness. Mm-hmm. And these are the things that you engage with when you are successful. This MBA situation where everybody's learning about what a rational thing business is and a lot of weird bogus stuff about teamwork and spirit. And I read a tweet from one of the business schools, and it was classic. It said it was as if it was news, and it said, there are still hierarchies in many corporations. And I thought, what are they telling these people? There's hierarchies in the Boy Scouts, for goodness sake.
It's not as flat as you thought, kiddos.
There's hierarchies in the place you buy your bagel in the morning. I mean, yeah, I don't know what they're telling
people. Yeah, but wait a minute. You're dissing teamwork and spirit and you're promoting madness?
No, I actually think there is teamwork within hierarchies. I mean, you have to what I think essentially is that my curriculum looks at things like constructing a suitable and sustainable business persona for yourself, so you have the right to project something and then but also retain it for yourself when you get home. There's a part of you that's still just you. Mm-hmm. I look at selling, the qualities that involve successful salespeople. I do a pretty deep dive on that. I look at the issues of managing, which I see as a four-part process, managing others and managing yourself, managing up and managing down. Mm-hmm. These are all, you know, very rigorously looked at. This is really not silly stuff.
It's kind of a real deal approach. Here's the real deal.
Yeah, the idea that wit mm-hmm. is somehow incompatible with truth. I don't know when we developed that, but people are constantly surprised by saying, well, you know, your stuff it's funny, but I also am finding it useful. And I go, well, thanks, you know.
And
I
mean, why not, sir, madam?
Put in 25 years of suffering in order to achieve some of these things. And I would hope that they're true, but I will tell you that people who take everything too seriously, they don't understand what's going on.
Are you getting the evil eye from your peeps at CBS? There must be tons of MBAs, B-school guys and gals around you there.
really, in many, many organizations, there are not tons of B-school people. I mean, I think if you go to Goldman Sachs, maybe there are tons of B-school people because that's their discipline. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody's ever faulted for not going to law school if you're not in a lawyer-type situation, if you're not in a legal situation. But this idea that business is an enormous playground. It's mm-hmm. an enormous field. And the idea that you need this very narrow set of circumstances taught by people who are not particularly successful themselves in business, what do you need it for? Get out on the field and use your real skills.
Stan Levine, it's so great to have you with us. The new book is The Curriculum, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Master of Business Arts. Hear a little bit from How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
How to observe personnel. How to select whom to lunch with. How to avoid petty friends. How to begin making contacts. How to walk into a conference room with an idea. Brilliant business idea. Is all that I need. How to succeed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with humorist and business columnist Stan Levine about the lowdown on B-school and the MBA. He says, skip it. You'll be fine in business without it if you just get savvy. He's happy to help you do that with his new book, The Curriculum, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Master of Business Arts. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. There are and have been a lot of schools out there ready to sell you a B-school education. Here's an ad from Thunderbird School of Global Management, Glendale, Arizona.
Thunderbird Global MBA On Demand is a distance learning degree program that allows participants to earn a master's in business administration without leaving their current job, personal, or family obligation.
Hey, it's going to be great, but back to the Wharton Follies. There's a little self-awareness that it can be silly, too. The Wharton's annual spring comedy show. Here's two fake recruiters discussing one job candidate, dissecting the merits of the almighty resume, even the eggshell paper it's printed on.
Duke, engineering and economics, Citi, Goldman Sachs, then private equity, Brazilian jiu-jitsu and boxing.
And it's eggshell with phone number and email in the same row divided by a vertical line.
Boom, great resume. Stanley Bing joins us from New York. Stanley Bing, lots of callers for you. Mike in Cincinnati, you're on the air with Stanley Bing.
Hi, Tom. I had a sort of a negative reaction to what Stanley's saying. On the one hand, I agree. Some of the things he's mentioned are certainly valuable to learn, and some of them are not taught in business school, but I have an MBA from a top 10 program. And the sort of things that he thinks are ethereal or silly, you know, those things ebb and flow and they change over time. When I was a business school student 20 years ago, they talked about focus on the customer and providing solutions, you know, not products, that sort of thing. But you know, there was tremendous value and tremendous learning in getting analytic frameworks, fundamental analytic frameworks in all the functional areas of business, as well as integrative thinking, how to think across those different functional areas strategically.
Yep.
It was a tremendous education, and I can see the difference between myself and people who didn't go to business school. And I agree, you can succeed without going to business school, but there's tremendous value in that. I can't discount it and say that what he offers is going to be a replacement for that.
Hey, Mike, stick with us. Stanley Bing, here's Mike in Cincinnati, top 10 B school, and he's got an analytic structure here for integrative thinking and all the rest out of his experience, really values it. What do you say to him, Stanley?
Then I think it's terrific. You know, I mean, I'm taking a bit of a radical position on the thing. I do think that for $35, my book may offer, you know, almost as much as you get for the $200,000. But I do think there's some value in in the analytics he's talking about. I will tell you that I was at Westinghouse during the years you probably were at business school, and we talked incessantly about the customer, and we went to quality college, and we had meetings about quality circles, and we were wrestling with the very same issues that you were doing in business school. And that is not to say that the business school stuff is worthless. It's not. I mean, it's helpful to people. I just think it's oversold. I mean, I got out of an airplane the other day in Oakland, California, and I saw three massive commercials for various MBA programs to people who were just hadn't even left the airport yet. So, you know, I think there are certainly disciplines and there's certainly people for whom MBAs fit. And, you know, attacking MBA schools is a hook on which to base my curriculum. But on the other hand, there's a wide range of things that are ignored in the classical rationalist approach. You can't ignore the rational, but at the same time, you can't ignore, you know, what happens to people when they don't remain one drink behind their boss.
Well, Mike, in Cincinnati, you say you went 20, 25 years ago. I presume if things worked out well, you now hire and fire people. And hiring in particular, is it the price of admission for you, Mike? Do you look for that MBA stamp on your new hires?
No, not at all. But it depends upon the type of position you're trying to fill. And like mm-hmm. I said, people who are very intelligent can learn quickly, and they can they can absorb the values and learn the skills. Yes, but I have to say, there's really something to be said for somebody who is immersed in that environment, who's learning those skills, getting the cross-functional training, the integrative thinking, as well as just being in an environment where you've got CEOs coming to speak to you weekly. You know, there's a lot that you absorb there. So I thought it was invaluable, and I was like a sponge when I was a student there, and I feel that it was
great for you. Mike, we've got it loud and clear out of Cincinnati, putting up the sword and shield for B-School right there. Thanks, Mike. Let me get one more here from New York City. Andrew, you're on the air, Andrew.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
I'm a longtime Stanley Bing fan.
So you take wit with your truth.
Well, I only wish he came along with this advice years ago, just as I was deciding to go to Columbia Business School. I did one term and was summarily expelled. I got back in and finished and got my MBA by the skin of my teeth, but I couldn't agree more based on my own experience with what Stanley's talking about here.
So maybe you were not a good fit, but what was the problem? What was your assessment, Andrew?
My assessment, it was my problem. I went to business school, I'd gone to very liberal arts, Brown undergrad, and I went to business school thinking I would learn the basics of how to start and run a business, thinking someday I would own or manage something, whether it was a building, a team, something.
Yeah.
And maybe it was a function in part of the time, the early 90s, and the fact that it was New York, that it was so incredibly quantitative-oriented, almost completely absent anything to do with entrepreneurship, in my experience. And I just got blown away by the quantitative aspect of it. Again, I begged and pleaded to get back in, and I did finish. But I think Stanley mentioned there are maybe five or six things. I came up with three. I think supply and demand, when the big I goes up, the little I goes down, and the time value of money. And maybe right. That and sagacious nodding, and I think I'd have been set. So for $35, I think I'll invest in the book.
Oh, Andrew, I'm glad to hear from you. Stanley Bing, what do you say? Skin of his teeth, he made it, but it was a choppy road.
Well, I think it's a good story because these analytics and, you know, this rational view of business is valuable, and there are a lot of people who can gravitate to it. But, you know, if we take even a moderate point of view, my curriculum is a great addition to what they're learning in business school because they don't really have their arms around things like, the guts and the kind of psychological issues that drive people on a day-to-day basis. I think, you know, our pro-business school fellow was right on the money about what's valuable about business school. And, people want to spend the money and want to spend the time getting that. But I know, you know, so many people who have great brains and who are very good business people, particularly in a lot of the areas like, you know, interpersonal areas, sales, communications, this is not, they're not going to teach you some of the things that I'm interested in, you know, beyond even selling books. You know, I'm interested in what makes a great salesperson, what makes groups work. There's a chapter on group dynamics, which is very important because you have to understand meetings. You really do have to understand meetings beyond what the purpose, the stated purpose of the meeting is. So these are issues that are very broad and are in my core curriculum. And then I get more granular on, you know, such issues as the care and feeding of senior officers and town car management.
Can we look at I want to look at that for a minute. Mike mentioned all the CEOs that he saw operating through his time in B school. For a lot of people who have or have not gone, NBC's The Office is kind of their Bible on, you know, what an office is. I got a couple of clips here that maybe will give you a jumping off point. Here's Michael Scott, played by Steve Carell, is the idiosyncratic regional manager, explaining of Dunder Mifflin, explaining his view on staff appreciation.
Do I need to be liked? Absolutely not. I like to be liked. I enjoy being liked. I have to be liked. But it's not like this compulsive need to be liked, like my need to be praised.
Love that one. And here's the regional branch manager on how we'd like to be seen as a leader.
Would I rather be feared or loved? Easy, both. I want people to be afraid of how much they love me.
Steve Carell in The Office. Stanley Bing, all right, give us some advice from the curriculum on the Office template here.
Well, I mean, you know, this is the classic boss of a small operation or a large one. I mean, you know, one of the things that the book deals with, as my previous books have done, is how to deal with the pathology of senior management. The, you know, normal people are eventually elevated into positions where they're required to lead other people. And this creates, you know, enormous strain on their personalities and cracks most people. Actually, it cracks all people. And so, you know, I had a kind of chuckle to myself just a tiny bit when our friend talked about he heard from all of those CEOs. And I thought that would be very interesting because, you know, most of them are, you know, have brain dysfunction in one way or another. They're either need to be loved when they're not lovable, or they need to be obeyed when their orders are not correct. And, you know, I mean, I think they would admit it. All you have to do is just look at the horror stories and sort of amusing stories of people who are dealing with leaders. So another issue in the book that's throughout is how to deal with people who, like, you know, who are leading Dunder Mifflin.
Well, I'm looking here at one of your charts. This is on build personal qualities that build the X factor, and I guess that's the X factor for high leadership. And you've got some sort of low range ones: rage, paranoia, hypersexuality. But then the high range, the big builders are delusions of grandeur, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and narcissism. Are you saying those are pluses?
In business, they're pluses, yeah. Mm-hmm. In real life, they're not really pluses. You meet a narcissistic person who only talks about themselves, then you're annoyed and eventually try to leave the room. If you're in business, then you're sitting in a classroom listening to that person because they're a CEO. If you're dealing with people who are OCD and, you know, extremely focused on minor details, you're very annoyed in real life. But in business, that's probably your CFO. So, I mean, it's very important for people to understand that at the office, the more power people have, the bigger that they are, the more their personal quirks and foibles come out because, you know, people crack in one way or another under pressure. And narcissism is absolutely necessary quality for moguls. I mean, you know, it's the old thing about, you know, let's talk about you. What did you think about me? You know, and that's pretty much what's the standard operating procedure.
So are you saying it's actually a positive attribute here? It builds a mogul, therefore builds an empire, therefore it's good business.
Many negative aspects about everyday life in people become assets. In other words, the bully that no one liked when he or she was 7 years old and terrorizing the playground is now quite possibly, in a Darwinian sense, been selected out to be in the corner office. And I, you know, I wish it wasn't true, but there are horror stories about Gandhi. So, I mean, you know, everybody, when they have a certain amount of sway over other people, they use it well a lot of the time and they use it poorly in other times. It's extremely important for the 90% of people that I'm writing for to understand how pathology and how crazy people thrive and prosper in business and in the workplace in general. You know, when you say business, people think everybody's wearing a suit. This is true. I worked in theater. This is way true in theater, where the director is a madman or a madwoman most of the time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I've seen it in virtually every place that I've ever worked. This is not just about suits and ties and things like that.
Hopefully a marvelous madman or woman. Catherine in Medford, Massachusetts. Catherine, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to say that I cannot wait to read this book. It looks like it was tailor-made for me. I've been debating for a long time whether or not I should have gone to business school. I've run a business for 23 years. I owned my own Subchapter S film company, and I now am the director of a nonprofit business. And I feel like I'm missing something. And a friend was telling me the other day, who has been to business school, that I'm not missing anything, that I've run business and that's a good kind of experience. But I'm always feeling like there's some tools, there's some language, there's some way of looking at things that I'm missing, and I feel that.
I mean, you've run a business for 20, 25 years, and you're still thinking about whether or not you might want to benefit from going to business school.
Yes, yes. I always feel like there's some lack in my education that I don't have the framing. I mean, I do everything sort of from my gut, and I learn as I go. And I keep thinking I might be more successful, or I might have been more successful had I been to business school and had, you know, if I just knew some of the tools. So when I read and I hear you talk about there's 7 or 8 essential things you need to know, and even the sagacious nodding, gosh, that's going to be really helpful to me.
Stanley Bing, give us a little assessment here. I mean, here's Catherine, after all these years of actually doing it, still thinking about, you know, because there's that magic thing that she hasn't quite got. Is it waiting for her?
Well, one thing is clear to me is that Catherine may not be egotistical enough to function at a very high level. She's got to build that egocentricity that's the mark of truly powerful leaders. But no, you know, I think I understand that. And I think that many of the issues in the book are aimed at that same kind of feeling. In other words, I think people are at a loss a lot of the time thinking about how to manage sort of unmanageable situations and how to grow when there's no evident growth in the business or in your own personal kind of life. And I think that's one of the things that I share with the classical business education. They take a rational approach at how to deal with each of these things. And, you know, this curriculum is structured rationally. I mean, it goes through major to incredibly minor issues as the book goes on. And I think the thing that I share with the traditional approach is you want to eventually have a strategy that you're excited about. To be reactive all the time, to think, what do I do about this? I don't have a strategy. That's the essence of non-business thinking. Business thinking is to develop a strategy, even if it's not a great strategy, even if the situation is really very difficult or not amenable to solution, you've got to have a strategy. And that's what my book is about. And I think in its own way, that's what a classical business education is about. It's looking at problems in a strategic way. It's just that many of the problems that I'm interested in are more dynamic and personal and less about, you know, sort of how to approach raising money and other things. Although raising money, what could be more personal and irrational than that? Just look at Silicon Valley.
Yeah, very few things, I think. We've got more to look at. Errors in work habits. We'll dissect those and much more with Stanley Bing. His new book is The Curriculum, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Master of Business. Stanley Bing, please stand by in New York. Catherine, thank you for your call. Here's money from rappers DR Period and Fly Tie. Maybe not out of E-School. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with humorist and business columnist Stanley Bing about the lowdown on B-School and the MBA. He says, skip it. You'll be fine in business without it if you just get savvy. He's happy to help you do that. His new book is The Curriculum, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Master of Business Arts. Bob's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You know, I think listening to this, we're talking about the things that B-School teaches. What we need to really be talking about is what they're not teaching. They're not teaching ethics. And we've raised a whole generation without ethics. And their moral bankruptcy led to our nation's financial bankruptcy in 2008. And guys like, you know, Glenn Hubbard at Columbia and the deans of the business schools want to take ownership of everything financial, but they're totally unwilling to take ownership of the ethical.
Stanley Bing, is that eat your spinach stuff or very real?
I think it's a very serious issue, and I think that there's a lot of truth in what he says. In fact, certain business schools like Wharton have been absolutely instrumental in creating the mindset of looking at business as if it's numbers on a spreadsheet that can be manipulated to the benefit of people. At Stanford, you know, they're basically a startup factory where, for the most part, except for some very famous exceptions, they're creating entities that are created like cotton candy, create great wealth for just a few people and perhaps a few bloggers, and then dispense into the air without a trace of having ever existed.
You mean Candy Crush? Are you talking about the – is that what you –
I think, I think you don't even know. We don't even know. Oh. What happens is that these startups start up and then they're suddenly worth a lot of hundreds of millions of dollars. And then they're bought by a company that doesn't really know what to do with them. And then the startup guys make a lot of money and the venture capitalists make a lot of money. If you go to dinner in San Francisco, you're with people who are in their 20s and they're talking about, you know, that they're on their fourth or fifth startup and they all have like 10 to hundreds of millions of dollars, and you ask, what did you start? They say things like, you know, nose press or whatever it is that they started, and there's no evidence of it. I have more problems with the whole concept of unfriendly takeovers and buying things with debt that came out of business schools in the 80s and 90s and created many of the problems that we have now, including, you know, the run-up to the 2008 thing, which I'm sure was engineered not only by MBAs but by Harvard quants.
But what about this? So, one of our listeners, Toyota, writes online, you know, she hears you talk about not appearing stupid, but then writes to us, I read recently that top innovators and venture capitalists were talking. One of them was asked, what is a truly innovative idea? And the VC responded, it's often an idea that looks totally stupid, but in hindsight makes perfect sense. His example was Twitter. Avoiding stupidity, Toyota wonders if it's a mistake.
I'm just flummoxed. I don't know what to say about that. Maybe if Steve Jobs had a stupid idea or somebody who's a venture capitalist can back up a stupid idea, I think it's a great thing. I know what she's saying, take risks, and that's a great thing. But if you're in a business meeting and you appear stupid, you know, that's the level I'm talking to people about. You don't want to look stupid unless you have a lot of power. Powerful people can look stupid because there's no such thing as a stupid idea coming from a powerful person.
Errors in work habits, and you've got lust for praise, crazy hours, ostentatious exhaustion, desire for hugs in progress. I'm not sure what that means. Work in progress.
Oh, please. You know, I'm working so hard and you know, gee whiz. The desire for hugs is a great demand on all senior officers, and I speak as a senior officer. You can sense when people need a hug, and everyone eventually at one point or another needs
thing.
One.
Yeah.
It's not, except when it's relentless. There are some people who need a lot of hugs, and you know, a lot of people who have gotten to senior positions are not the warmest people in the world. I think we've all noticed that, and the desire for hugs can be, you know, it can be an intense thing for people to deal with.
Watch out. Errors in work habits to be forewarned of. Stanley Bing does it in The Curriculum. Gene in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Gene, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Well, gentle people, it's nice to talk to you.
You too.
Perhaps I'm listening to this and coming around to the original idea that I was going to call on. I was an associate dean and I created an MBA program and ran it. And we happened to be producing the program for about 25% of the land mass of the state of Wisconsin.
For MBAs, a business administration program, Jim.
I created it and ran it.
Did you do a good thing with that, Gene, or not?
Aha. My undergraduate major is philosophy and English, and I was a liberal arts graduate. And I found that the most effective thing I could do, both as an administrator and as a teacher, as a professor, was to use the subtle techniques, the loving techniques that exist in liberal arts, and apply them to successful careers in business. There happens to be a very, very famous business school, university in Chicago. I will leave it without a name. And unless you can put it into an equation, it doesn't exist. And I taught in their master's, in their executive development program. So I guess the point I'm trying to get across is the most effective tool that I would use when I was in the classroom was to plant an idea or make a statement that might contradict and just let the class loose. So you had 25 junior executives out there, and they'd get some prodding. But it was so important that they interacted with each other and exchanged ideas.
Gentle Gene, we've got it, and I so appreciate your call. Our time is short here. Stanley Bing, I want to ask you how that squares. Here's Gentle Gene. He's done it. He's started it. He goes for the loving techniques of liberal arts, but I'm looking at your chart for the most productive forms of craziness to succeed in business, and by far the biggest one here is bullying.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm describing the graduates of the course that he taught in Chicago. You know, I mean, I think that I'm describing things as they are. I agree with Gene 100%. I mean, I think the big lack is that no one can write. And I think you'd be doing a lot more good for people in business school to have an entire, you know, concentration on being able to express your thoughts in you know, meaningful ways. I don't want to single out any business school, but if their magazines and their journalism that they do is any indication, it's a lot of them are essentially unreadable. They're gobbledygook, and it's the kind of writing that obscures lack of ideas with a lot of verbiage, and it's the kind of stuff that I'm sure Gene was dealing with his students. I love the idea of the way he's describing getting people to talk about things, getting people to share things and trade things. I mean, I hate to sound soft at the center, but I think it's great stuff, and I think that's the kind of thing that makes business fun for people. And hopefully, you know, when I'm talking about group dynamics and meetings, I'm getting to some of that, you know. So I don't have any problem with the kind of business school that Gene's talking about.
Wit and truth from Stanley Bing. Have you got a parting piece of advice for that maybe on the fence, might go to B school, might just go into business person?
Yeah, if you want to look at a rational way of doing business, I think, you know, there are business schools that would be good for you. But I do think, you know, my book can teach you some valuable skills and may lead you to a way of doing business that's a little bit more human.
A little bit more human and plenty of humor along the way as well. Stanley Bing, the new book is The Curriculum, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Master of Business Arts Without B-School. Stanley Bing, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was fun, Tom. Thanks very much.
In a moment, sky-high executive salaries. This is On Point. In corporate America, it is very sweet to be at the top. And despite years of complaint over lopsided rewards for top managers, it is getting sweeter. There's a new raft of numbers out on the highest paid American bosses. The numbers are eye-popping. Joining me now to take a look is Lynn Stout, professor of corporate and business law at the Cornell Law School. Lynn Stout, Professor Stout, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Tom.
It's great to have you here. What do we see in this latest report on executive compensation?
What we see is pretty much what we've seen for the past 20 years, is that every year the packages seem to get bigger and bigger. Interestingly, this has not been accompanied by better performance for shareholders.
So I'm looking here at the list of top earners, and it starts off with Larry Ellison, top guy at Oracle, famous for that. Total package there, $78 million. Robert Iger at Walt Disney, $34 million. Rupert Murdoch, of course, with his 21st Century Fox outfit, $26 million. And then, you know, we sort of just go on down, $25 million, $25 million, $23 million, $23 million. And I understand this list doesn't even include some of the very biggest earners whose formulas somehow just don't fit this survey. Are these records? Are salaries back where they were before the Great Recession?
Yeah, pretty much, I think, is the answer. And what's really interesting to me about this pattern is that it's a relatively new phenomenon. Executives were not always paid this much.
So when did it take off, and what's still propelling it in a time when there have been all kinds of supposedly performance-based formulas put against compensation? Are all these guys, mainly guys, not all, but are they just doing so fabulously in their jobs that it just makes sense?
Well, it turns out that actually you've put your finger on the problem. It's the performance-based formulas. Most people don't know this, but once upon a time, executives were paid simply whatever the board of directors thought they should be paid. And oddly enough, boards of directors paid them a lot less. The average top executive earned $1 million or less 25 years ago. But we changed that in 1993 when Congress changed the tax code. Congress thought it had this great idea, mm-hmm. and the idea was to try and rein in executive pay by requiring corporations that wanted a tax deduction to base executive pay on these formulas. And what we've seen really is that this has been a little bit of a disaster. Instead of reining in pay, what the formulas allowed was for executives to work the numbers so they got huge payouts.
How does that work? I mean, on its face, you can see why Congress went that way. Performance-based compensation sounds like an absolutely sort of, you know, bedrock American idea.
It does, doesn't it? And I think that's why we all bought into it. And you know, it's a little hard for people to recognize this experiment didn't work very well. And the reason is you need to recognize that it's actually impossible for a human to come up with a formula that will always make sure that the executive gets paid if and only if he or she does a good job running the company. The problem with business, as any business person will tell you, is that things happen that you didn't expect. It's complicated. And even formulas that look at two or three factors – and by the way, many of them are not that sophisticated. Mm-hmm. Some of them are based on things as simple as share price and dividends. But even formulas that try to be sophisticated end up inevitably leaving out all sorts of things that we didn't think of that we really care about. And in the process, what they do is they invite executives to focus on the formulas instead of focusing on running the business well. And obviously, this has served executives very well. They're really good at managing the formula, even if returns from owning public equities have been flat or declining for average investors.
Boards of directors are supposed to be watching out here, but are they complicit in this? You're suggesting almost manipulation of performance-based compensation for the executives' advantage. And if they are, why would they be?
Well, I don't think the executives – I'm sorry. I don't think the directors plan to come up with numbers that executives could manipulate. Just the reality is, and I think we finally need to admit this after 20-some-odd years of experience, we still haven't figured out how to come up with a formula that executives can't manipulate. But it wasn't because the directors wanted it that way. Oddly enough, when Congress changed the tax code to require directors to tie executive pay to performance, what they did was they actually made boards less accountable. Now boards can say, hey, it wasn't us that decided to pay this guy $75 million. It was the metric that made us do it. It was the formula that made us do it. And I think that's one of the reasons why, oddly enough, back before 1993, when boards had more discretion, they also had more accountability. If they decided to give a big pay package to a CEO, they had no one else and nothing else that they could blame. It was their decision.
American top executives now quite commonly making 100 or 200, in the extreme, sometimes 300 times the average worker in their companies. I'm reading here from Thomas Piketty. He's written Capital in the 21st Century, and he says it is possible to find hardworking managers who are willing to be paid 20 times the average wage at their company rather than 100 to 200 times. Is that true, or have we built a system wherein top folks expect to have super multiples of their average wage in their firm?
Piketty is absolutely right, and we know it from experience. We know it because back in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, when investors were, for during most of that time, getting much better returns, executives were working for a lot less money and doing a great job. We know you don't need to pay that much because in the rest of the world, CEOs are not paid that much, and yet they do a great job. Look at Germany, which has terrific corporate performance and CEOs who receive much less in pay.
Is it a business problem? Is it a social problem? How do you look at it?
Well, I think
or is it not a problem?
I think it's definitely a problem. It's not good for societies, and it's been demonstrated over and over that the more inequality you get in a society, the worse its overall economic performance. So whether you care about fairness or whether you care about economic growth, both of them are harmed when you get these really severe inequalities.
What about the ones at the bottom, the sort of the 10 lowest paid chief executives in this survey of 100? I mean, if you've got 70, 80 million at the top, here at the bottom, we've got 5 million at Costco, 4 million at Sears, 4 million at Apple, 1.2 million for Stephen Ballmer at Microsoft. Did they mess up?
No, of course not. They're doing an excellent job, and those companies are performing very well. And it's just more proof that you don't actually need to offer these huge pay packages to get good people.
Lynn Stout, distinguished professor of corporate and business law at the Jack G. Clark Business Law Institute at Cornell Law School. Professor Stout, thank you very much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure, Tom.
In the week of Passover and anti-Semitic gunfire, tomorrow in this hour, we look at the history of the Jews with acclaimed historian Simon Shama. Join us for that. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.